Hello, I hope you can all hear me well, despite the noise from whatever it is here. Give me a wave if you can't at any point, and I'll try and shout a bit louder. Looking around, you're all, I think, probably of a generation that does podcasts rather than watches television. But if you're a little bit passé, then you may have heard of a television program called Would I Lie to You? I rather like it. It's a show where there are two panel teams, and one of the people on each panel tells a story, and the other team has to guess whether or not what is said is true or not. Would I lie to you? How do you know where the truth is? How do you determine it? What is truth, said a jesting pilot and would not stay for an answer, is a quote from a famous Lord Chancellor, Sir Francis Bacon, quoted by Aldous Huxley. But the question, really, that arose so far as Pilate was concerned was whether the man in front of him was innocent or guilty. He was, as it turns out, a corrupt judge. And he was faced with a man who was accused of treason, but said that he was a king from an altogether different place. And once more, he said that he came to testify, to give evidence about the truth, with the authority of someone who came from that other place. And Pilate's stance was simply that of the cynic, namely that truth either wasn't discoverable, or more probably in his case, that it didn't really matter compared with what he wanted to do with his own life. Realpolitik. But of course, the whole process of law is based on the premise that you can discover the truth by reference to what we call evidence. And Pilate knew in that case where the evidence led. It should have led to an acquittal. He said three times the man was innocent, but nonetheless he convicted him, trying to limit his own responsibility for doing so. He didn't let the evidence get in the way of what he wanted to do, of the way he wanted to live. Well, it's the evidence that's important in any court of law, as I would always say to juries. I would tell them that they were not to investigate matters on their own, not to look on the internet, not to read the newspapers, not to take into account things that other people said, not to talk to their families about it. Discard all extraneous things from your thinking, accept the evidence, and the evidence is what you hear from that witness box, I would say to them. Decide this case on the evidence and the evidence alone. Set aside all your preconceptions, assess the evidence for what you think is reliable and accurate, and then come to a verdict based on it. And that's true for both juries and judges. In the commercial court, I decide cases myself simply on the basis of the evidence. Courts have to work on that footing. And what I suggest to you is that the same thing is true when you come to look at any of the big questions in life. You've got to assess the evidence to see where it leads. And it's the appropriate test to apply when one looks at the question of Jesus and what he asked his friends to consider. And one of the major questions that he asked them was to think about who he was. Who do you think I am? Who do you say that I am? And I often wonder what Pilate really thought the answer to that was. Well, if you are a lawyer, you will know that evidence takes essentially two forms in a court of law. The direct evidence of a witness in the witness box, someone who gets up and swears on oath as to what it was they saw or heard or did or experienced. The second form of evidence we see is where you have a witness statement or an affidavit which records what a witness says that he saw, heard, did, or experienced, and sometimes other records in writing to the same effect. And there are rules about what's admissible and what isn't, but the basic test is simply what is the comparative reliability of one form of evidence as against another. And what's true for judges and juries is also true for historians, isn't it? On what basis do they get to write their history textbooks? Well, it's the evidence that they find in the shape of written records of what people said about what happened, either at the time or as near to the time thereafter as they can find it. And they give appropriate weight to the interests of the person who wrote the record in question, to see whether they have reasons to try and justify themselves or to exculpate themselves, whether they have reasons for telling the truth or telling lies, whether they have reasons to be accurate or inaccurate, all the things that juries would consider too. And these factors will then determine whether the historian thinks that what he's got is a reliable record and whether it goes into his book or not. And findings are made simply on the basis of what best fits the evidence. The evidence which is seen as reliable and accurate. So when I would address juries, part of the summing up, you say to juries, you say words to this effect. You say, members of the jury, you may draw inferences from the evidence that you accept as being reliable and accurate. And when I say you may draw inferences, what I mean is that you must come to common sense conclusions based on that evidence. Look at the evidence as a whole, I would say. Search for the most probative evidence and the most cogent explanation for the facts as to what occurred. Now usually in my experience in court, the evidence almost invariably points to one conclusion rather than another. And in a civil court of law, that's all you have to do. You have to decide what's more probable or not, the balance of probabilities, we call it. What is more likely to have occurred than not. But in a criminal court, a jury has to be sure, beyond reasonable doubt, as we used to say many years ago, that a person is guilty before they convict him. But that's basically how the search for truth is conducted. And actually, it's how you operate every day in the ordinary things of life, if you stop to think about it. So if you were somewhere around here and you stopped and asked for directions to Vivat Bacchus, and someone told you, you'd assess whether what they were saying was reliable or not. From the way they told you, from the authority with which they said it, you'd have to make a judgment. And in fact, when you stop to think about it, almost everything that you think you know has been told to you by somebody. When people tell you something, do you accept it? The whole of education proceeds on this basis. What you're told by a schoolmaster, a schoolmistress, a lecturer, a don, whatever it may be, and by and large you accept it as reliable, don't you? And work on that basis. You decide what you're going to do with it on the basis of your acceptance of it. And you make decisions in every area of life exactly on that basis when you stop to think about it. What I do want to say is this, that just because an issue may be difficult to resolve, and you will have this in work, you don't throw up your hands and say, I can't decide. You assess the evidence and you come to a conclusion. To do anything else would be stupid, would be a waste altogether. And so what I'm suggesting to you is this. There is such a thing as truth, and it is ascertainable by reference to evidence. And that's why I asked Tom to read those verses from the beginning of Luke, which you may have open in front of you. If you look at the opening verses, you find out what the task was that Luke was embarked on. He explains that many people had drawn up an account of what had taken place on the basis of what they were told by people who were there at the time, eyewitnesses. They had recorded it, and he himself had decided to write an orderly account, having investigated the matter carefully with those eyewitnesses, so that his reader could be sure about what he'd been told. In other words, Luke was trying to write reliable history based on the evidence of eyewitnesses. The evidence of people who had been present at the time, of the various events which he then goes on to describe. And as you read it, you can see that what he's really saying is, I've got this information from the horse's mouth, from those eyewitnesses, so you can be sure about what is being said. I take it that he records in his gospel, which is different in some of the events that he records from the other gospels, that he records what he was actually told by those eyewitnesses. Matthew and John, who were there at the time, they'd record what they themselves saw and heard. And the general thinking is that Mark recorded what he was told by Peter, another friend of Jesus, who was there at the time. But the whole point was that anybody reading this could be certain, could be sure about what had happened. Where you and I are concerned, the evidence for Jesus is to be found essentially in the records we have, in those Gospels that I've just referred to, telling us of Jesus' life, his death, his teaching, his resurrection, and his ascension. And the real question is, what conclusion can we reach based on that evidence? Is it reliable? And if it is, what's to be done about it? And the key issues here, I think, come down to three questions. Who is Jesus? What did he do and why? And does it matter? And Luke considered the evidence was so certain that his readers could be sure the basis of the standard of proof in a criminal case. So very briefly, let me just consider with you the evidential weight of the New Testament. How would you look at these records as compared with anything else? And how can we certain that there is reliability in them? And the example that's normally taken is of another character of about the same sort of historicity, Julius Caesar. I guess you all know a bit about Julius Caesar. If you belong to a particular generation, you would have been forced to read his Gallic Wars that he wrote in Latin. We used to have to translate them at school many years ago. Perhaps nobody does that these days. But what do we know about him? Well, he fought the Gallic Wars. He tells us as much in his history. He came to Britain, 55-54 BC. He goes back to Rome. He crosses the Tiber. He enters. He seeks to become emperor. He exercises a huge amount of influence. And he's then assassinated because the people in favor of a republic don't like the idea very much. Killed by Brutus and Cassius. Now, does anybody have any real doubt about that? No. But when you ask, how do you know that? What records have we actually got now? You'd be looking at about 9 or 10 manuscripts that came into being about 900 years after the events in question. But no one has any real doubt about the reliability because they're copied from earlier records, including some written by Caesar himself, which are going to be regarded with a measure of skepticism because he's bigging himself up, isn't he? Records, nonetheless, that constitute copies of earlier material. With faithful copying, historians can be confident about the source. And then if you were to look at the records for the New Testament, you'd find something completely different. You'd find literally thousands of manuscripts that are far older than any of those that relate to Julius Caesar. So if you go to Dublin, you can see the Chester Beatty Papyrus, as it's called. And that's a record of four Gospels and the Acts that goes back to about 200 to 250 AD. Papyrus, of course, rots. So you have to copy it again and again and again. And people took great care in that. You've only got to read about what the monks did in various monasteries, how careful they were in copying to see that. And there are fragments of these Gospels that go back much, much earlier to about 130 AD. Go to the John Rylands Museum in Manchester and you can see a fragment of John's Gospel. There are, in fact, about 25,000 manuscripts of varying antiquity, but all far older than those that we've thought about for Julius Caesar. And they represent what, in the view of any serious scholar, is a record that was written by those who were eyewitnesses at the time. So we can be confident that what we've got is an accurate record of what eyewitnesses themselves say they saw and heard and experienced. And so I suggest to you that you should approach the New Testament and give it the weight that accords evidence of that kind, the sort of evidence that any lawyer or historian would look at and evaluate. Now, of course, you'll say to me, Julius Caesar is much more ordinary in the things he did. The things that we hear about Jesus are extraordinary. And therefore, I approach that with a different level of skepticism. But can I suggest this to you? There isn't any need for suspension of disbelief here. People who lived in Palestine 2,000 years ago were not gullible simpletons who would readily accept that a man could, with a word, calm storms, or raise someone from the dead, cure of disease or madness. There's a story about Jairus' daughter, and she dies. And Jesus, coming to help her, says to people around, she's not dead, she's asleep. And they all laugh at him because they know jolly well she's dead. But the point is that Jesus was able to wake her from sleep. That's what the story tells us. That's what the narrative is about. And Luke, who's a doctor who writes this down, he knows that's extraordinary. And that's why he records it. And one facet of Luke's narrative is this, that people, in fact, never seem to doubt the fact that a miracle has occurred. What they do have trouble with is what the explanation is. The historicity of the event does not appear to have been in doubt. And the issue which Luke always raises is this. What sort of a man can do this? Jesus' disciples ask the question after he's calmed the storm with a word. What sort of a man is this? Who is he? Furthermore, if a man whose ethical teaching is still considered the highest morality of anyone, a man who valued truth and decried hypocrisy of all kinds, if that person who has such a high regard for truth claimed to have supernatural origins and power over death and predicted that he would rise from death, then we need to look at those claims and see whether they stack up. It's got to be examined seriously and carefully to see if there's something in it. People around at that time didn't think that dead men simply came alive again, got out of a tomb, walked around, ate, drank, were able to be touched, could walk through doors. They knew these sort of things didn't happen. And yet they say it did. And Luke was a doctor. And if anybody you'd have thought was well aware of life and death and those sort of issues, then he would be. So that's why Jesus asked his circle of close friends, who do you think I am? First, he said, who are other people saying I am? And they say, well, some sort of a prophet, Elijah or Elisha, come alive again or something of that kind, someone with good things to say. But that's not really an option, is it? It's a verdict many people would like to come to about Jesus, to say he had good things to say. Just read his Sermon on the Mount. But a person of morality and integrity, whether a prophet or from God or not, doesn't make the claims that Jesus made if he's only a man. A claim to be the Son of God, equality with God. And so Jesus presses his disciples for a better answer. And the question is, where does the evidence lead? Where did it lead them? And where does it lead you? And the ultimate critical point arises from his resurrection from the dead. Though Jesus predicted it in advance, none of his disciples took it on board. They thought he must be speaking metaphorically. It can't be real in that sense. And Luke tells us that when Jesus first rose from the dead, and the report was given of it by women, the band of Jesus' followers, who are men, none of them would accept it at all. And they wouldn't accept it until Peter reported it, someone they trusted it, and they encountered Jesus for themselves. then Jesus explained its significance and they accepted its truth. They wanted evidence for their own eyes and someone they trusted. Thomas, perhaps, who you may recall, is the best example. He wasn't prepared to accept it at all unless he could actually grab hold of Jesus. There are plenty of books that set out the evidence for the resurrection, and I can recommend them to you at the end of this talk if you'd like to look at them. And indeed, you can go on YouTube and you'll find I've given a few talks on it myself. But it's compelling stuff to any lawyer when you look at what the real options are. What are the real possibilities for what happened at the time? But Jesus knew full well that even that would not convince some people of his authenticity. Because what I suggest to you is the problem is often not really one of evidence at all. Because no serious scholar doubts the existence of Jesus, and the evidence of his high moral teaching is there for all to see. You can just find it in the Gospels. Someone must have given that teaching. But what causes people to jib now are the claims that he made about what he was, who he was, what he came to do, and the need to respond to him in some way or another. And Jesus told a story to illustrate the point. It's a story about a rich man who lives in a mansion. He's dressed in the most expensive and fashionable clothes of the time, and he's described as living in luxury. He obviously has a very large property because it didn't front onto the street as most people's houses did at the time. It has a portico, a gate. And in the shadow of that gate, there would lie or sit a man, a beggar. Lazarus, he's called in the story. He could be found there every day and he's suffering, and he would gladly have eaten any of the leftovers that the wealthy man had to impart, but nobody gave him anything at all. The mansion owner could see this man every single day, but did nothing whatsoever about it. And Lazarus is plagued by dogs, scavenging dogs, unable to fend them off from his ravaged body. And life continues in this manner, in the way Jesus told the story, in the two men's living conditions. And from what emerges later, we discover that Lazarus, the beggar, had a right relationship with God, whereas the rich man did not. He's caught up with his own living, not concerned about other people or about the God who made him. And the story has these two people in a contrasting position after their death. And Jesus puts it like this. He says the beggar is described as sitting next to Abraham in paradise, whilst the mansion owner is in Hades, and he's described as being in agony and asking Abraham to send Lazarus to give him a drink. And the answer that Abraham gives is that it can't be done. Can't be done because of the way in which they've both lived their lives and because there is a huge chasm after death between the two respective locations that can't be crossed. And then the mansion owner has an idea. It's the first show of concern in the story that he shows for anybody else. He's thinking about his brothers. And he says to Abraham, send Lazarus to warn my five brothers that they don't make the same mistake that I've made. And Abraham says in the story, what's the point of that? They've got their Bible, the Jewish Old Testament. They can read that. That tells them what God wants. That tells them how they should respond to him. They've got the law and the prophets. No, says the mansion owner. If only someone would rise from the dead and go back and tell them, they'd stop and think again. They'd repent, to use the word the Bible uses. And Abraham's response in the story is to say this: if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if anyone should rise from the dead. And Jesus knew that's what he was going to do, and it wouldn't convince everybody because they weren't prepared to look at the evidence. And Jesus' story is aimed at those who won't consider the recorded evidence of what God has done, whether in the Old Testament or the New Testament Gospels. Some people will never respond, regardless of his resurrection, and however powerful the evidence for it is. He said he was a king from another place who testified to the truth. But some won't examine the evidence for that, because putting your trust in Jesus has consequences. And there's a fear of where it might lead and what demands it might make of you. I run a men's breakfast down in Sussex, where most people are my sort of age. And I've had a number who've come to me and said, well, Jeremy, I believe all of what you say is true, but I can't bring myself after 60, 70 years to commit myself to it. It would involve a complete change in the way I live. And they won't do it. Now, I couldn't persuade you just in these few minutes of the strength of the evidence in favour of the resurrection of Jesus, or of the Christian worldview as explained by him. But what I can say is the evidence is there to be investigated, and you need to come to it with an open mind to see what impact it really has. And to look at it and think, if it's true, what does that really mean for me? And I think we'll see, I saw on a bit of paper here, there's a course called Hope Explored. That's a good way of finding out more, of looking at the evidence. It's on that flyer. Tom will probably say something about it. That would be a good place to start. It's a three-week course. It's 3 weeks of about an hour and a quarter once a week. Or better still, just get hold of a gospel and read it. And even better, read it with someone who is a Christian and discuss it with them on a one-to-one basis. That's the way most people I know in recent years have come to understand what Christianity means, what it's about, and come to be convinced and follow Jesus. If you want to know more, I'd be pleased to discuss it with you, to help you in any way I can. Tom will do likewise. And if you want a book that I can recommend, let me just recommend two to you. The first one is Can We Trust the Gospels?, which says some of the things that I've been talking about. And this one, The Case for Easter, by a journalist who started off with the idea of disproving the truth of the resurrection and finished up believing it and writing a book about it. Easy reads, but powerful. Thank you very much, Tom.